From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Mohammed El-Shenawy, VOA Senior Middle East Reporter. Our topic on this edition of the program, Whither Libya? How can peace be restored to this strategically located North African oil-producing country? Our guest, a foremost expert on Libya, Jason Pack. He's a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington. Jason is also the author of An International Financial Commission is Libya's Last Hope. He is also founder of Libya Analysis, LLC. Over the last 10 years, Jason Pack has worked to promote UK-Libyan and US-Libyan commercial, academic, and governmental ties. In 2015, he founded EyeOnISISInLibya.com, and that's a nonprofit monitoring organization which details the group's history, its interactions with other jihadi actors, and Western actions toward the group. His articles have appeared in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and other international publications. Talks between the warring sides in Libya wrapped up last Monday in Moscow, with Russia's foreign minister noting some progress a day after a fragile ceasefire brokered by Russia and Turkey came into force. Russia and Turkey are emerging as key arbiters in the war-torn country, trying to push Fayez al-Sarraj, head of the internationally recognized Government of National Accord, or GNA, and his rival, renegade General Khalifa Haftar, to start agreeing to outlines of a longer-term political settlement, one suiting both Ankara and Moscow. The latest phase of the long-running violent turmoil that followed the 2011 ouster of then-dictator Muammar Gaddafi has been bogged down in stalemate for months. More than 280 civilians and about 2,000 fighters have been killed and 146,000 Libyans displaced since General Haftar, who is backed by Russia, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, launched an assault last year on Tripoli. Formerly one of Colonel Gaddafi's most trusted lieutenants, Haftar, since 2014, has been waging a campaign against the Government of National Accord, which is recognized by the United States and most Western states as the legitimate Libyan government. Just last week, Haftar's forces seized the coastal town of Sirte, Gaddafi's birthplace and scene of the ousted autocrat's brutal death. Both Russia and Turkey have much invested in Libya. Russia in terms of reputation, clout, and potential oil deals, and Turkey with even more wide-ranging commercial interests, analysts say. We'll talk with Jason Pack about the significance of the latest turn of events in Libya and why Turkey and Russia, as opposed to other Western powers and the United States, have emerged as political power brokers in Libya. And Jason Pack joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
And as always, I'm very delighted to welcome my colleague, VOA Senior Middle East Reporter Mohammed El-Shenawy.
My pleasure.
Well, Jason, there's a lot to talk about. Just discuss briefly as background the current division between the GNA, the Government of National Accord, which is the internationally recognized government, and the so-called LNA, the Libya National Army, run by or led by General Haftar. Remind us how and why this division came about in the aftermath of the fall of Gaddafi.
So the Libya situation is very complicated. Either you can look at it as a country which has two governments or a country which has no government. And in fact, in 2011, as Gaddafi was ousted by a series of popular uprisings supported by a NATO no-fly zone, in the wake of that, you had a bifurcation between the range of militia groups who fought against Gaddafi and a political class which coalesced into something called the National Transitional Council, or NTC, that was recognized internationally. Internationals pushed for elections. Those were held in the summer of 2012, and that gave rise to the General National Congress. However, that body failed to appoint a constitutional committee and failed in many other of its obligations, leading to an unforeseen election in June of 2014. Participation was low in that election, and mostly non-Islamists were elected. The Islamist as well as Misratin and Tripoli factions contested those elections and said that they were invalid. They forced the elected deputies to flee to Tobruk, and those elected deputies were legitimate for a period of time and called the House of Representatives. That is where the contested authority begins. At that time, the first war for Tripoli was initiated in the summer of 2014. a coalition of Tripoli, Misratin, and Islamist militias fought against those supporting the House of Representatives and Zintani forces. We have had a bifurcated Libya since that summer of 2014, and I consider, as do most of my colleagues, the Libyan civil war as beginning in 2014. Now, international mediation efforts from 2014 until December 2015 led to the Sakhrat Agreement, frequently referred to as the Libyan Political Agreement. That institutes the General National Accord Government, or GNA, that you referenced. Its Prime Minister, Fayez Sarraj, was backed by the international community and implanted in Tripoli in March 2016. His legitimacy was only supposed to last for 2 years. He's long overstayed his mandate, and there are many reasons that you could not see him as legitimate now. However, he's still backed by the international community, mostly the West, other than France. Combating his legitimacy is a range of actors who support Khalifa Haftar and his putsch to take over the East militarily, defeat the Islamists, and gradually militarily unify the country. His primary supporter is the UAE. I look at the UAE as an unconditional supporter. Come hell or high water, they'll support Haftar. Then you have a range of conditional supporters, the Russians, the French, and to some extent the Egyptians are a backer unconditionally as well as conditionally. Now on the other side, supporting the GNA, the Turks are unconditional supporters. They have something between 16 and 18 billion of unpaid construction contracts in the country that you referenced, and they have staked their international position on the ability to secure strategic interests in the Eastern Mediterranean for gas and oil deals, all on the GNA. Now, because the GNA has international and legal legitimacy, the US, the UK, Italy, a range of northern European countries see that they should, to support international order, support the GNA, but are unwilling to commit troops and significant monetary amounts. Therefore, what I'm laying out is a very complicated and confusing scene whereby, in the wake of Gaddafi's ouster, Western countries and legal means were important. But since Haftar's assault on Tripoli in April 2019, those powers who are willing to commit mercenaries or drones have gradually eclipsed the Western countries who are seeking to work on legal means. So rather than the US, the UK, Italy, and France being the main mediators, we've seen Turkey on the one side and Russia and UAE on the other because they dispatch drones and mercenaries. And therefore, the current ceasefire talks are happening in Moscow and are mediated between Ankara and Russia because they're the ones who have hard leverage.
Exactly.
And we have lost our place to have a seat at the table.
And quickly, before I turn to Mohammed, how do you see Haftar and his legitimacy or lack thereof? What is he after? Why is the GNA not a legitimate or reasonable mechanism through which to bring the country together, in his view?
As we've seen elsewhere in the last 3 or 4 years, power gradually gets turned into legitimacy. So when Haftar announced his coup or putsch, sometimes called Operation Dignity, in 2014, it had no legal basis. But the more power he gained, the more foreign supporters he had, all of a sudden, he got appointed field marshal by the House of Representatives. As soon as he was field marshal, he got invited to conferences, first in France and then in Italy. And that has snowballed into legitimacy, so much so that international talks consider him as almost a co-equal side with Fayez Sarraj, who is the quote-unquote legitimate prime minister of Libya. And in terms of what he wants, I don't think what he wants is simple, because he could have achieved power in Libya merely by playing along with the national conference process or the UN push for elections. What he wants is something, more megalomaniacal than that. He wants to be acclaimed supreme leader.
Like Muammar Gaddafi, maybe.
Something like that. I think the model is more like Sisi in Egypt, whereby an army can then make property deals, can do construction projects, and has no check and balance on its power. Mm-hmm. Because he had already won prior to his assault on Tripoli, because he's controlling 90% of the country's oil and 70%+ of its territory, and was going to win any election that would happen. It's very bizarre that he tried to win over the last population center that he didn't control, and he had no chance, and has made Libya descend further and further into this unwinnable and very tragic civil war with the humanitarian consequences you already outlined.
It raises many questions. But let me now turn to my Egyptian colleague, speaking of Egypt, Mohamed El-Shanawi, for a question.
Yeah, Egypt is backing Haftar's role in dismantling militias as he requested in Moscow. What could that lead to?
So the idea that Haftar has an army and all his opponents are mere militias is propaganda. In Libya, there really is no state. I would argue that rather than being two states or two governments, we have zero states. He has a coalition of militias that are slightly more centralized, and they fight another coalition of militias. Look at them as the LNA and anti-LNA coalitions. It's very convenient if you label your enemy as militias and then say, aha, I will only accept a ceasefire if they are dismantled. So that's not a starter as an ask. And simultaneously, the GNA has a non-starter for its preconditions for the ceasefire to move into real peace talks, which is reverting to the pre-April military lines so that anyone who made any gains has to go backwards. Those are non-starters, and that's why I look at the Moscow ceasefire talks as something like a media exercise. The Russians want them to show that they are prima inter pares and that the buck stops in Moscow and not in Washington or London or Rome. And the two sides, the LNA and anti-LNA coalition, all they really want to achieve is showing, hey, I got him to agree to my talking points. Moving forward on the real issues, which are economic and structural, hopefully at the Berlin conference on Sunday, January 19th.
But Turkish President Erdogan said Turkey will not refrain from teaching Haftar a lesson if he continues attacks against Libya's government and people. Would Turkey intervene militarily if Haftar continued his military campaign toward Tripoli?
So Turkey already has intervened militarily, and I would argue that Turkey is the most vested and involved of any of the powers and sides. What has happened gradually is that in the first Libyan civil war, and that's the period 2014 to 2015, Libyan actors fought each other but had outside support. What's happened in the second Libyan civil war is almost unprecedented in human history. The various outside actors fight each other on Libyan territory. We have the world's first extraterritorial drone war. The UAE pilots the drones, and the Turkish pilot their drones. Libyans are not involved in choosing the targets or in flying the drones themselves. So when Erdogan makes the threat that you mentioned, it's extremely credible.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jason Pack. He's a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute. That's a think tank here in Washington, and author of An International Financial Commission is Libya's Last Hope. We're talking about the state of play in Libya as Turkey and Russia compete for influence in that resource-rich but conflict-ridden country. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Mohamed El-Shanawi. He's VOA Senior Middle East Reporter. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout-out to a loyal Facebook fan, Paul Ngonga from Nairobi, Kenya. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Jason Pack, expert on Libya. Jason, remind us, what's really at stake here in Libya? Why is it so important that we try to end this conflict and restore stability? There's migration to Europe. There's the so-called ISIS threat. I wonder where that stands. Extremists flowing to other parts of Africa. Why is it so important, and why is it dangerous that only Russia and Turkey at this point seem to be active mediators? And mediator is probably a charitable phrase to use.
Frequently when it comes to Libya, the forest is lost for the trees. I would argue that Libya is strategic on no fewer than four separate dimensions. One is the military / jihadi or Islamist threat that you mentioned. The other is the state implosion, which allows migrants from sub-Saharan Africa to flow to Europe. And that leads to neo-populism in Europe. It is not extreme to say that Brexit, the election of Giuseppe Conte, Orban's continuing appeal are all driven by the implosion of the Libyan and Syrian states. And without them, we wouldn't see the rise of these right-wing neo-populist parties in Europe. So Libya is truly important for the European politics. Then there's another dimension, which is energy security. Libya produces sweet crude, and really only Libya and Nigeria can produce enough of this sweet crude which European refineries need to operate. Certainly with the threat of war in Iran, Libya is increasingly a swing producer. But then there's another economic dimension. Libya has over $100 billion in back payments to a range of international actors. And for the U.S., if a few of our multinationals are owed $5 billion here or $7 billion there, it doesn't matter because of the size of our economy. But for medium-sized countries like Turkey and Russia, being owed 10 or more billion is a significant part, particularly as their economies have been struggling over recent years. So that's a separate dimension than the oil dimension, this quote-unquote back payments issue. And then there's the thing of geostrategic location. Location is a different matter than just, oh, Libya is in the center of the Mediterranean. It's rather that a range of competing international systems interface in Libya. You could say that the Mediterranean, the African, and the Middle Eastern international systems all meet in this geostrategic location of Libya, and that sucks in like a vacuum competing power interests. So what I like to tell people who've not thought much about Libya is that Libya is the world's fifth most important conflict, but the only one that's solving it can pay for itself. Because if you look at Ukraine, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and North Korea, these are for the most part poor countries that the international community spends billions to help out or try to fix. Libya is a rich country that it's not being fixed. Costs money. If we would fix it, Libya would generate over 1 million jobs for guest workers, and it would spend billions of dollars on infrastructure, and it would give hope and positive stability benefits for all of these interlocking systems that I mentioned. It's a tragedy then that major powers who have the ability to help fix Libya don't invest small pain and resources now for big gain later.
And that leads me to ask you, do you think that the growing influence of Russia and Turkey is a symptom of the failure of Western efforts to solve this 9-year conflict diplomatically?
Sure is, Carol. And in fact, the Russians and Turks are playing the role of senior statesmen, mature men in the room. And I don't want to instantly poo-poo, oh, Russia bad or Turkey bad. It's not that simple. They're able to convene both the militias that support them and those that oppose them. And they're able to deploy real political capital. It's surprising that the West is now playing catch-up. And catch-up may be good enough. So, for example, because the Turks passed an act in their parliament which allows them to legally put troops into the country, only in response to that did the Italians say, you know what, we may look at the mission that we did in Lebanon in the 1980s, revamp it as a way to have more of our special forces in Misrata to give us more stake and leverage. I mean, this is something that the Italians, both as peacekeepers and special forces, should have been doing over the last years.
So do you think that aside from his economic and commercial interests in the Mediterranean, that is Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, could he be using this intervention as a means to, in fact, force the international community to accelerate their efforts to forge a negotiated political settlement?
Well, that's a very altruistic way of looking at at Erdogan's motives. I would word it slightly differently. And again, this is something that I think is not presented enough in the international media. We have an asymmetrical conflict in Libya. The GNA has international legitimacy and the ability to access billions of dollars of Libya's sovereign wealth, but lacks international supporters. The other side, the LNA coalition and the House of Representatives, lack international legitimacy and lack the ability to access funds, but have a lot of international supporters who are willing to give it money and arms. So this is very asymmetrical. As soon as Russia, the UAE, and Egypt support Haftar and the LNA, the GNA didn't want to have to rely so unilaterally on Turkey. They came to Algeria, they came to America, they came to London and said, help us.
Wow.
They paid for lobbying contracts, such as the famous one with Mercury. None of that has culminated in getting the trainers and the drones that they need to defend themselves. Keep in mind, they're the defenders of their capital city.
Exactly.
The Turks are the supporters of last resort. And an interesting thing is that when you're high and dry and you really need to be saved, the knight in shining armor who comes to save you can ask for anything. Give me your hand in marriage. Sell me your daughter. You know, anything that they want. And what the Turks asked for is, give me your maritime resources, such that the Maritime Accord, it's a memorandum of understanding proposed and signed in November of 2019, gives something beyond what the GNA actually can legally offer. It gives a joint zone of economic influence connecting Turkey and the Aegean Sea all the way to the coast of Libya. But this doesn't make sense. It bypasses Greek and Cypriot and even Israeli territorial waters. So the GNA gave away something that they have nothing, no legitimate right to offer. It violates what's called UNCLOS, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, and really complicates the maritime zones and potential to look for gas in these territorial waters. But because the Turks were the saviors of last resort, they've driven a very, very high price. And this is going to complicate all of the gas exploration in the region between Egypt, Israel, Cyprus, Greece, and Turkey.
In other words, you're referring to the accord that Erdogan signed with the GNA.
The MOU, yes.
Right, this MOU to create an exclusive economic zone in the eastern Mediterranean as Ankara competes for resources among other regional players that you just cited, Greece, Cyprus, and Israel.
But what Egypt.
And Egypt.
All of whom nominally supported Haftar beforehand, but have now been thrust into the role of being major players. Greece has been a minor player that now that their ability to be a hub for natural gas is threatened, they are using the EU and trying to manipulate EU institutions to sanction the GNA. This is a huge escalation, and it's an example of how Libya's strategic location that I mentioned sucks in actors.
I have a question for Mohammed.
Let's move now to the U.S. role. The head of the GNA, Faisal Sarraj, met Tuesday in Istanbul with U.S. Ambassador to Turkey, David Satterfield. What's your take on that?
So it's interesting, of course, that Satterfield is the former U.S. Special Envoy to Libya. So Satterfield is a true expert on these issues, and that's a very significant meeting. It's no secret that since Haftar launched his assault in April of 2019 on Tripoli, all of the Libyan factions have gotten lobbyists here in Washington, because Washington has not committed to one side or another. Officially, the State Department backs the UN government, as does the Pentagon, but unofficially, President Trump has an attraction to aspiring dictators of every sort, and he has played footsie, essentially, with Haftar. He's had some of his, you know, his friends and his billionaire donors and whatever interact with the Haftar sphere. So the lobbyists from all sides descended here on Washington and are trying to compete to get the U.S. to back their faction, or, from a mature perspective, to just get the U.S. to play the role of mediator and adult in the room. That has yet to happen, but there are some positive indications. On Congress, there is the 2019 Libya Stabilization Act, which is a pending piece of bipartisan congressional legislation that has been proposed in both the House and the Senate, which would see the U.S. role and ability to sanction spoilers increased. I think that that's very beneficial. Simultaneously, there is talk of a potential presidential envoy. There hasn't been any U.S. envoy to Libya since the inauguration in January 2017. So that would be amazingly important to give the U.S. its traditional mediating role.
Now the U.S. is invited to the Berlin conference. Do you think the United States can play a positive role in that conference to facilitate a peaceful solution for the Libyan conflict?
I think whatever role the U.S. plays, it is positive. Whether we will use the true leverage that we have remains unseen. The U.S. is the giant in the room. We can sanction both sides. We control what's called the SWIFT code system, which is needed for international financial transfers in and out of Libya. We also have the ability to use our role in the oil markets, such as the things that we've done in Iran, which is enormously meaningful to police international oil markets. So this is an example of a conflict in which the U.S. is still the most powerful actor. And if we would snap our fingers and say, you know what, all of a sudden, such and such account is frozen, or the CBL, the Central Bank of Libya, can't do this kind of transaction, this would bring various groups to their heels. What I'm hoping for could happen out of Berlin is a unification of the rival central banks, which is something which is within reach. And I gave a joint event on Monday, January 13th, with the deputy UN special envoy to Libya, Stephanie Williams, who is a retired American diplomat who is now a UN functionary. And she understands the U.S. role as a potential mediator, and that when the U.S. issues a threat, we can get our allies on both sides. So, for example, we're allies with the UAE, which is on one side of this conflict, but we're also allies with Turkey via our NATO connection on the other side. So if we are able to play hardball and issue threats, it's not impossible that the Berlin Conference could have a real meaningful momentum generator and lead to what I would like to see, which is an international financial commission on Libya, recognizing the fact that the Libya conflict has as its root cause financial and economic issues. It is the perverse incentive structure of Libya's semi-sovereign economic institutions and governance structures which give rise to the militias as well as the jihadis. So if we attack the financial incentives, which are the root cause, then we could uncut the cord which gives rise to all the violence and the militia proliferation.
That's a terrific explanation. Jason Peck, where does the population stand in your view? Do we have a sense of, you know, who they're backing, the East, the West? We know that, you know, Libya is a big country and there are lots of differences, but do you have a sense?
Well, that's another very important question, Carol. Frequently, the populations are left out when we discuss things like the tragedies of the civil war in Syria and Yemen. In Libya, the population was mobilized against Gaddafi, and probably 80% supported the rebels against Gaddafi. Since then, things have become more complicated. There are local coalitions, but so much bifurcation. So if we look at a town like Sirte, you can't say that the population in Sirte supports Haftar or supports Sirraj. There are tribal elements in there because they're connected via the Forjan tribe, which Haftar comes from. But then there are others who are more tied to Misrata and oppose Haftar. Roughly put, this is not a war that the population fights in. They suffer from it. The militias right. are able to generate funds by smuggling petrol, by engaging in what's called letters of credit fraud. And then you join a militia because that's where the jobs are. And that's something that throughout Africa is very common, that you need to join a militia to, you know, be able to support your family. The Libyans have suffered and would like to see this war end. They are against what I call the status quo party. Both sides benefit from the war continuing. Libya has a classic war economy. In a war economy, there's no reason for the incumbent powers to solve the war because they're either siphoning off cash into their Swiss bank accounts or they're smuggling petrol. And the population, they don't get to see those benefits.
That's very unfortunate. And as we conclude, just reiterate or discuss just briefly why you think that an international financial commission is Libya's last hope, the title of your recent paper.
Well, every other kind of mediation attempt has been tried. We've done stakeholder approaches. We've done population-centric approaches. We've done mediation to try to get the jihadis out. All of those have failed because they look at treating symptoms. You know, you can take Tylenol from, you know, now to the end of the day. You're not going to fix your broken foot. You have the pain because the foot is broken. Libya is broken because these perverse financial incentives, which are so complicated that it's difficult to explain in this format, but let's just say that there's free money which is given to the Libyan people, and then subsidies, for example, making petrol very cheap or the importation of various goods at non-market rates. If you have arms and you can hijack petrol going to a petrol station and sell it for four times as much in Tunisia, you're not going to be able to undo the militias because the militias will just want to exist to benefit from this subsidized money and subsidized petrol. The International Financial Commission, which I propose, needs to sort out many different layers of the Libyan economy. For example, the billions which are owed to foreign creditors. Those billions cause foreign intervention. But then also, it needs to deal with the fact that Libyans get paid money for doing nothing by the central government. If we could rationalize the Libyan economy, we could cut out the incentives to join militias, and also we could cut out the incentives to fight for Tripoli. Tripoli is the prize that Libyans fight over because it's where the semi-sovereign economic institutions like the Central Bank, the NOC, the Housing and Infrastructure Board, and things like this are based. If we can make a more rational Libyan economy, there will be money which flows to the Libyan people and to the local areas and is spent in a rational way, and there won't be a reason to try to do a power grab to capture these illicit spoils. Libyans are wealthy enough that everyone can benefit if we could just end this war.
Jason Pack is a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute. He is the author of An International Financial Commission is Libya's Last Hope. He's been working tirelessly to promote ties between Libya and the United States and the UK. Jason, thank you for your terrific insights about Libya, and we hope to have you on again.
Always a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rob McLean. And joining me on the program was VOA Senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.